It's time for Cutting Edge Consciousness with Freeman Michaels and Barnett Bain. Thought-provoking discussions and bold ideas from the edge of possibility.
And welcome to Cutting Edge Consciousness. Freeman Michaels here with my co-host,
Barnett Bain. Good morning. Nice
good
to
morning.
See you. Good morning to all our listeners, all our listener. Boy, I hope not. Huh?
Right.
Advertisers love that.
That's right.
Take that
speaks
back.
In singular, not
yeah,
plural.
Yeah. So it's good to see you this morning.
Yeah, it's good to be seen.
Freeman, you know any good jokes?
No.
I thought we would just tee it up.
Yeah, no, I'm not really a joke guy.
You're not. Of course, you just get. Your kids bring home jokes.
Well, my kids bring home knock knock jokes. Yeah, not the best jokes.
Those are funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are really.
We don't want those.
Funny thing about kids and knock knock jokes, and we wonder. We think it's so obvious that everybody has a different sense of humor and that humor is so developmental, and yet we never ask ourselves whether. Everybody is up to dealing at the same level with all the challenges of life. You know, I was watching the debates last night, and some of those responses were very, very sophisticated, and some of them were shockingly unsophisticated.
So this sort of knock-knock developmental stage of consciousness, can we officially brand that?
We can. It'll be in our creative...
Well, that's kind of the knock.
Your creative advantage.
The book promoter, the knock-knock stage.
It's the knock-knock stage.
Yeah. And this is interesting because one of the things about the kids' movies these days is I'm pleased to see that many of them have a more sophisticated, dimensional kind of humor. Not all of them.
Not that the kids are getting that because they shoehorn it through the knock-knock consciousness.
Yeah, they do. They do. And frankly, look, there's a lot of adult movies that are at the level of knock-knock.
Are knock-knock consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I think most romantic comedies are kind of a knock-knock. It's a formula, right? Boy meets girl, boy can't have girl, boy gets girl, boy loses girl. You know the routine.
Sure.
And so we go through it again and again, and we know. I mean, every knock-knock joke, you know the punchline before it's even, you know, it's a setup for the same thing. It's almost like the commedia stuff where the commedia was the Italian, teatro, the theater stuff, and the characters were so formulaic.
All
but they're,
stock.
They're meant to be. They're all stock characters, and all the routines are the same. You know,
well,
it's like a Laurel and Hardy routine.
This is.
That's what politics is, by the way. I mean, it doesn't matter who you move the furniture around.
Yeah.
Different
but
players.
They're not as nuanced as, I mean, when you speak about the comedia or Shakespeare, for instance. Shakespeare
right.
dealt with very stock characters
right.
so that he very well knew that he was writing and playing to a knock-knock culture.
Well, you know,
and at the same time, there is the most powerful, the most sophisticated, the most conscious wisdom is layered into those mess in and between the comings and goings of these knock-knock situations for people that have the ability to hear it.
And I don't want to repeat the conversation we had before, but when we're talking about the mythologies and our sort of personal mythology and how there's these sort of archetypal mythologies and then there's our sort of own individual interpretation of it, which matches our own personal mythologies and these sort of themes of our lives that tend to play out in the cyclical pattern where we're replaying and replaying and replaying with different characters playing different roles, of course, but that it's highly thematic.
Well, what I extract from this is that...
Please extract
I'm
something.
I'm going to extract something. Is that we develop as individuals and as cultures we develop as well. And that is a somewhat clumsy segue into the discussion that we want to initiate with our guest, which will have something to do with the culture of business on the whole. Is there such a thing? Can we reasonably expect that business is going to flat out evolve and be in pursuit of interests that are resonant with our highest interests?
Right.
Any more than we can expect certain aspects of ourselves or people in the world who are functioning at a developmentally appropriate knock-knock level?
Right. And frankly, with business, I know we want to segue and get them on, but with business, I see the command and control power structure, that sort of typical rule by fear and rule by might and force and so forth, as kind of a knock-knock stage of development. We can get into that later, but I mean,
so
there's, out there.
We're sort of going to set this up by as we agree that there are there is a knock-knock level developmental stage in business as there are in human beings, and then there is a there are more sophisticated and more conscious levels of interpersonal relationship and personal relationship as well as business relationship.
I love it.
That it's time to bring on our secret guest.
Don't tell anybody.
We're not going to mention any names, but he is here with us. We have today my friend Rinaldo Brutico, who is the president of the World Business Academy, which was founded to educate and to inspire and to assist business leaders, including knock-knock business leaders, to take responsibility for the whole of society. Rinaldo is an expert in emerging tech and industries. He was co-founder and CEO of the nation's first pay cable TV channel, operation, Channel 100, and the CEO of Universal Subscription Television. He served for 13 years as the chairman of Logical Data Management, is on the boards of many companies, including Men's Warehouse. He's the CEO and chairman of the Red Rose Collection, named for three consecutive years to Inc.'s magazine's 500 fastest-growing privately held companies. And he is here with us on Cutting Edge Consciousness, and we are very, very happy that you've joined us.
Thank you, Barnett. Thank you, Freeman. Nice to make your acquaintance, Freeman.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. I've heard about you, and obviously it's an illustrious career you've had, and you're the perfect person to address
the knock-knock stage issue
of business development.
You know, I think the fun thing about that, I was listening, obviously, with rapt attention of your knock-knock jokes, but the business went past that a while ago, and I think we entered a phase with business, I'm going to say about the time of the Industrial Revolution, where business began to look for what it was going to do that was different than what it had been doing for all of recorded human history prior to that. Prior to that, business had been an instrument of service. And then if we want, we could talk about how this all started with the very first exchange in the Middle East where one farmer growing a barley-type crop called groats was down the road, and he needed to get his groats to market, but there's a guy who was a pig farmer and he had the protein and he couldn't stop working with the pigs long enough to go buy some groats. So a guy got in the middle of those two and said, you know what, I'll take your groats over here and give them to the pig farmer. I'll take the pig farmer's pig, give you one of those over to the groats, and I'll just take a little slice for me for making it possible for you guys to stay at work all day and growing your groats and raising your pigs.
The investment banker.
No, that in that case, that was truly a
service.
Pardon me?
Still a service.
Yeah, it was a very facilitative role. It was a role where the business person was performing something that society needed.
Yeah.
Because we had to keep the big farmer with his pigs, we had to get the growth farmer with his growth. So that coming from service is how business began. And what happened post the Industrial Revolution is business forgot that. And as it became the most powerful institution on the planet, which it is today, so it's more powerful than any government. Do you know that more than 55% of the largest 100 economies in the world today are individual businesses? They're not countries.
Wow.
And so what's happening is we have this transnational state called multinational corporations. And everybody's caught up. And if you're selling tortillas in Tijuana on a street corner, you're in international commerce because your corn that made the tortilla had to come from California. And the price of that corn put the farmer who grew corn in Mexico out of business. This is one example, and that's actually a true fact I just gave you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because it's so powerful, business has this unique responsibility. And what my good friend Willis Harmon used to talk about a lot was, it's like looking at the days of the Holy Roman Empire. You know, for good or bad, the Pope was sort of in charge of all the kings. Because there needed to be some organizing force that sort of regulated the whole gonfalon. And in order to do that, the church at that time, the Roman Catholic Church, saw itself as both a temporal and a spiritual leader, and they were like sorting everything out, keeping it all moving along. Business today has that same responsibility, meaning it's responsible for the whole of society because as business goes, so goes the planet. Now, the problem is we've gone so far past the knock-knock stage that business is capable of not only being deadly at a local level, business is now creating basically a scenario of death on a global scale. And we need to look at that death and destruction as one option, And we need to look at the second thing, which is heaven on earth, as the other option. And business can create either.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do we get them to create the one we want?
And I like the way you're going, too, with tracking back to the sort of initial building blocks that were the principles behind the decisions to move into these business transactions. I mean, I like, and Barnett and I, we've spoken about this on the show before, just looking at money where, you know, initially, if I was, let's say, a pig farmer, whatever, and you were a chicken farmer, and you had, I don't know, a bunch of chickens, and I had some pigs, and I said, look, I'd love some chickens, and I got some pigs, and you were willing to offer me, let's say, 5 chickens for a pig, and I went, you know, I really don't need 5 chickens. You might give me 1 chicken and 5 markers, whether it was gold pieces or shells or beads or something that we all agreed, okay, that's going to be a marker that represents a chicken, and I could either come back later for more chickens or I could give that to the guy growing the wheat. And the whole idea of currency was that it was meant to be, these markers were meant to be ways of creating this currency, this flow of good and service between people. They weren't intended. I mean, back then, if you had said to someone, well, I'm going to hoard the markers, you know, that would have been absurd. Like, why do you want the markers? That's not important. Those are just markers. I mean, great, you have some markers so you can exchange them, but the idea of hoarding them and the idea of identifying with having a bunch of markers as being something is a kind of, in my mind, and maybe, I don't know if you share this with me, but it represents a kind of imbalance where the principle behind that exchange has been distorted.
Yeah, I love what you're doing here. You're basically raising the consciousness of money. And I want to put a lens around this to get a kick out of all of the money that transacts every day. If you take all the money that happens everywhere in the world every day that goes from point A to point B, right, from my pocket to your pocket, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Of all that money that transfers hands every single day on the planet, what percent of it buys anything? Meaning buys a product like a chicken?
Almost nothing, like I'm corn. Sure. Almost nothing.
Take a number. What is the number?
Point 0 something.
You're very close.
Oh my goodness!
You're very close. Yeah. It's less than 2%.
That's a tremendous perspective.
We are now pushing around vapor that is not grounded in any good or service.
Precisely, and so I'm so glad you guessed that number, because most people think that most money is used to buy something, and most money is only used to buy other money. And what's interesting is, that way, you can create as much money as you want out of thin air, because money stops being relevant to anything that any human does. So right. How did you get into a system? How do we get ourselves as a species into a system where the original purpose of money, as correctly, I think was you, Freeman, or Barnett was articulating the...
No, it was me, Freeman, but it's also something Barnett talks about in the same terms. Yeah.
So what you just focused on, which I love, is you focused on it had a purpose, and now it doesn't.
Well, this is this kind of loops back to where we were talking about vis-a-vis the knock-knock sensibility. These are developmental processes that are reflected at large in the same way that they exist initially in every individual. And it is developmentally appropriate that individuals and cultures grow to in a way that becomes self-serving. And eventually a maturity dawns, and the system of self-serving values begins to deconstruct, and what is birthed instead is an awareness that the self is a larger system, and something new is born. You, to tie this into something very specific, I heard you speak someplace, and pull up my note on this. You said that the highest history of deficit ever to GNP in the history of the United States was recorded sometime around 1946. It was so high at that time that no one could conceive of how we would ever pay that debt off. And what happened from 46 to 66 is that we experienced the greatest economic boom of all time. So in the process of doing that, our debt shrank as a percentage of GNP without anyone having to do anything at all except enjoy the fruits of a society that was equal and fair vis-a-vis the development of consciousness at that time. So here we are in 2012, and either you said this directly or I dreamed that you said it, or you should say it, or you will say it. That deficits do not matter at this stage. Jobs do. Therefore, what is the future of us of business reconciling the realities of a new economic, emergent economic model with the obligations, these obligations to vapor indebtedness, as we've just pointed out, 0.00 something of real value.
So, first of all, I have said it.
Thank goodness.
Several times.
That's fantastic. We hate to quote you when you haven't said it yet.
No, I've said and just to put a plug in, I do a free radio show, a blog radio show, which you can find out about. We keep them all listed on our website at the World Business Academy, which is www.worldbusiness.org. And we list the topics of each of the shows. But if you go back, and we've got the last 2 years of shows there, one a month. And on numerous occasions, I have dealt with this subject. And it's about deficits don't matter issue. And specifically, what they do matter in one sense in the long term, in that they can become a destabilizing force. However, they don't matter right now. And, in fact, discussing them and trying to solve them is insane. It is literally an act of self-destruction.
It's a distraction.
No, it's more than a distraction. Distractions you can get past. It's suicidal.
Okay, gotcha.
Because in every single economy in the country, in the world where this has been tried, and but most recently it's been tried in the UK. Cameron came to office saying, I'll cut our way through austerity back to a healthy economic growth, and UK went into a double dip 4 months ago.
It's murderous. It's murderous because all you're doing is doubling down on the domination culture that thinks that is self-serving in a way that they don't have to provide good or service except to move around and manipulate concepts.
I unfortunately am going to be the timekeeper here. We have to take a commercial break.
Oh, no.
No, but this is juicy. So here's what we're going to do.
We have you for the full hour, so we're going to come right back after this message from our economic sponsor.
Welcome back to Cutting Edge Consciousness, thought-provoking discussions and bold ideas from the edge of possibility.
And welcome back to Cutting Edge Consciousness. Freeman Michaels here with my co-host Barnett Bain and our incredible guest,
Ronaldo Brutico.
Yeah, Ronaldo Brutico. And Barnett, before we left for the break, you were in the middle of a thought that I knew was going to lead us down a path that would be very interesting. So please, jump back on.
Well, I was simply reiterating something that I'd heard Ronaldo say someplace, sometime. The bottom line of which is that deficits don't matter.
Austerity measures.
And austerity measures to deal with them is deadly.
It's like pouring gasoline on the fire.
It's poison.
Yep.
And so we were about to invite Ronaldo to comment further on that and to propose what other possible models for a revitalized or an innovative economics might look like. With that, Ronaldo, I'm throwing it to you.
Great. I like gas on the fire. I think that's apt. But the word I used was suicidal,
right,
which really is an act of self-destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing particular or ceremonial about it. It's not done for some noble purpose. It's done out of pure stupidity, or in this case, out of greed. So why we're talking about deficit has nothing to do with solving the economic problems that are afflicting America. You know, here's a question I'd ask every listener. When did we give up on the idea in this country that a single person working a normal job could support a family of four? So that somebody could be at home with the kids. Where did we give up on the idea that somebody could be good enough and smart enough to qualify for college or graduate school and be able to graduate not owing $100,000 or more in debt? Where did we give up on the idea that we could continually raise our standard of living indefinitely and do so at a time and in a way that would better serve planetary environmental needs than destroy it? When did we give up on what I call the American dream?
Yeah, I think it got co-opted. I feel as if, personally, this is Freeman speaking, that there is an orientation towards, it's an expression of a kind of imbalance where the principles that you went back to, this cooperative exchange, the idea of service and the idea of facilitating that service and really being part of something bigger than ourselves, got lost in the competitiveness, trying to win.
I wish you were right. I'm afraid you're not. I think it's all much more nefarious than that. Let me tell you what I think is happening. If you track what's happened in the last 10, 12 years, and I can actually extend this back 25 years, if you track the last 10, 12 years, what you're going to see is the amount of money that is aggregated in the top 1% has accelerated so enormously, and the money aggregated in the bottom 87 to 88% has gone sideways or down. That does not happen by accident, gentlemen. In every society, there is a tendency towards aristocracy. In every society. In good and healthy societies, it is balanced by a sense of the common good, the common need. What's happening in the United States is that we have become, without realizing it, victimized by our own internal aristocracy. And they're getting to be fewer and fewer in number, and they're aggregating more and more money and power. And with that, they're able to influence more and more electorally that they want to. And you got five people in the United States that are writing the checks for most, for two-thirds of the Republican Party candidates. Five guys basically buying elections right now.
Well, what are the kinds of models, Ronaldo, that are being discussed here and there? New models of a new economic, of a new approach to capitalism, which is, if I think, is an adolescent. Not to say that there's anything wrong with capitalism, but I think it needs to mature and to grow into a model of what can it give as much as what can it get. And that I know that there are discussions all over the place of interesting new possibilities, reverse interest and local currencies. And what are the kinds of things that you think are prescriptive?
First of all, I've written extensively on local currency. I've just got an article going to press now on creating regional and sovereign currencies that are compatible with, like, I call it a neo-drachma you have simultaneously with the euro.
Speak a little bit about that.
I love that stuff.
I will in a minute. But before I get there, just something I want to touch on that we skipped over. I want to go back to the first question, the last question, which was about what the alternative is.
Yeah.
And what I want to just address very briefly is this, and then I'm going to come back to capitalism. We have a model of what happened between 1946 and 1966. We have the exact model. We know that one man, who this nation honored above all other men, took his entire prestige and laid it on the line and said, if you trust me for what I just did for you, please trust me and vote for what I'm telling you is the smartest thing you could do for the next 20 years. And that man was a very, very famous general named George C. Marshall. And George Marshall, who people don't realize it, Eisenhower worked for Marshall. Every general, every admiral in World War II worked for Marshall. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was the guy that got all these extremely different personalities. There was nothing that an Eisenhower had in common with a Patton, and very little that a Bradley had in common with a Bull Halsey. These guys were extraordinarily talented stars, each in their own universe, and this guy, George Marshall, got them to all work together in a concerted way, in such a manner that the world has never seen before and may not ever see again. George Marshall, in 1946, went to the president, Truman, and conceived what we now call the Marshall Plan. Originally, it was called the Truman Plan. But they said, Mr. President, if you call it the Truman Plan, we can't get it through Congress. George Marshall just won the war, and in those days, Marshall was far more popular than Eisenhower. Everybody trusts Marshall because we know he won the war. Let's call it the Marshall Plan and let him go testify to Congress and let him plead the case. So Marshall trots to Congress and says, I've had the good fortune of leading you through this last terrible conflagration. And I'm begging you now to know, it may be possible that we could have the next 30 years without another war, 20, 30 years without another war with Germany and Japan. I'm not promising you they will become our friends, but I know we should not repeat the mistake of World War I. We should not bear evil towards the vanquished. We should build them up so that totalitarianism doesn't strike again from the seedbed of that collapse.
It was brilliant.
It was brilliant. Yep. And then he proceeded to argue the Congress. The guy had just won the war, World War II. And he argued for 6 months. Do you know how many votes that passed by? One. One vote. It would have gone down, but for one vote. Now, in history, looking back, it turns out that what Marshall didn't understand was we were going to get richer than Croesus doing it. What he thought was an eleemosynary or generous act turned out to be a consciousness of support the other guy, and it actually supports you. In other words, it's not a zero-sum game. I gave it to Germany, so I don't have it anymore. It's actually, I gave to Germany, and now I got three because I only gave away two. And I gave away these three, and now I got four. So what happened is it was a huge explosion of economic growth because it turns out that what the United States does really well and needed to do in 1946 was it needed to learn how to build roads and sewers and factories, and we were good at it, better at that than making bullets. So we converted our entire economy back to peacetime. We not only raised all of Europe back up and all of Japan, all of Asia, We basically rebuilt everything, and we got richer than you can believe doing, and our deficit disappeared.
Now, this is brilliant because Barnett and I both speak about this, that if we orient towards what we can give versus what we can get, if we begin to recognize, and I'll make this as a very strong statement, that goodwill is the bottom line, that the relationships and the value of our of what it is we generate is more important than, again, that sort of small-mindedness of manipulation and trying to control, that if we actually build, the language we've actually used, and we had a guest talk about this as well, is it's an issue of farming versus just overemphasizing the reaping, that we really invest in things that are expressions of aspects of ourselves, things that we want to generate, that we look to create value and be of service, that actually is incredibly it comes back around again in a profound way.
Yeah, and there's actually a technical term in economics called the multiplier effect that explains how that works.
Yeah.
Now, deficit is the opposite. Deficit is a zero-sum thinking. Say, gee, if I pay a dollar here, I got a dollar less. Well, the answer is no, and this is an actual number, and anybody who's taken economics in the last 40 years has heard of the Samuelson book on economics, it's like the basic textbook. And it calls about the multiplier effect, which nobody disagrees with. You put a dollar into the civilian economy, and you get $5 to $7 back. Parenthetically, if you put a dollar into the military economy, you only get about $2 back. So the leverage you get on spending money in the civilian economy is dramatically better than anything you could possibly do with any other form of spending. Now, that idea, by the way, I wrote an article on this within 3 weeks after 9/11, and I said the solution to terrorism is not to go to war. The solution to terrorism is to eliminate the seedbeds of terrorism, which is incredible and dense poverty in places like Pakistan, Iraq, and et cetera. And if you eliminate those seedbeds of poverty, you might not get rid of the lunatic person who was ready to blow themselves up as a suicide bomber. But what you'll do is you'll change the community's willingness to support that individual because they won't want to have a piece of that game. Whereas the French say, men with full bellies don't make revolution.
Right.
So what we need to do is look at the Marshall Plan, and what we proposed in the Academy back after 9/11 was we need a global Marshall Plan. We need a Marshall Plan that will cause us to help rebuild ourselves and the entire planet, get off this military empire building kick with all the weaponry, and actually build something that makes a difference, which is sewers, roads, hospitals, housing. And we have to do it in a way that we recognize that the more we do, the richer we get, because that's exactly what happened between 1946 and 1966. Now, here's the good news. I have never seen, heard about, or read, and I do read it quite a bit, I've never seen, heard about, or read any problem in the place of the planet Earth that we can't solve with today's technology and today's resources. We don't lack anything to get the job done, except the will to do it.
Well, we have the will to do it because there are so many entrenched interests, and it's a topic beyond the scope of this short show to get into the entrenched interests, but suffice to say that there are developmental and evolutionary things that are bubbling up at the fringes and all over the fabric of even the old game that is symptomatic of something of emerging from the new game, and some of those things include the currency issues that are very much local. And I know that you have a lot to share with us about that.
Yeah, and it just happily to do so. But staying with the thing you said a few minutes ago about capitalism, just as an example, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I believe critical thinking is the most important skill we have to have people develop. That's what consciousness is about. It's about the awareness that we bring to what we hear, not what we hear.
But Ronaldo, the consciousness, you're absolutely right. We agree with you completely. But consciousness is per an individual. If the kids who love the knock knock jokes are not better than or less than, it is a developmental awareness. Consciousness is not a function of democracy. So I don't really know that. Congress is a petri dish for exploring this issue. We can see how when you throw together a number of people in a democratic forum and expect to find some consensus, that consciousness, either it comes to a standing wave, which is what we have right now, or it 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 either rises or drops to whoever is able to hold the pitch the most sustained pitch.
Again, I'm a business guy, so I tend to look at, you know, remember Watergate, follow the money?
Yeah.
You wonder what happened, just follow the money, they'll tell you. So take this word capitalism you just used.
Yeah.
Fascinating concept because it isn't even an capitalism is a
it's not an economic term.
Yeah, it's a political term.
Yeah.
So socialism, capitalism, communism, or any kind
political
of
term.
The word ism, it's a political philosophy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What is the economic structure from the United States? We are what's called a free market system as opposed to a command and control system. So the Russian system is command and control. The Chinese system is command and control. We are what's called a free market system, which means it can only work if our markets are free. And, gentlemen, our markets are
free. Not free.
That's the problem. Yeah. So now when you get a Congress, a democracy, if you will, in the middle of a rigged market system that's supposed to be a free market system, what you get is the worst of both worlds. And that's what you're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a level of self-destruction in this country that's been going on for 20 years that's just inexplicable. But for the fact that I think people got so fat, dumb, and happy in America between 1946 and 1966 that they forgot that it actually required them to be alert and paying attention. So they let their consciousness slip to the level of the lowest common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
Television helped them do that. And in the process, they sort of like tuned in and turned off. And what they got was they left people in the kitchen running the show who really only had their own interests at heart, the aristocrats. And now what you've got is a system where the Congress can't function because the rules permit unlimited buying of influence. And the revolving door that you know about is not only real, it's inescapable. So we have a system now in the country where before the Citizens United case was even heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, within 1 week after them granting certiorari, meaning the right to review, the Academy published an article I wrote which said, if this case is allowed to stand, it will be, A, the worst decision in the history of the United States, and I'm including Dred Scott in that example, and, B, it will destroy our democracy because it will unleash the final attack on our civil society, which is exactly what it's done. Now, what can we do as a population? Well, as you, some of you know, Bernie Sanders out of the Independent Center
Vermont.
From Vermont is saying that constitutional amendment. Great, Bernie. Takes a lot of time. I'm all for it. I already signed the petition. What else can we do? Well, why can't we do this? And by the way, I want to start this in California. I've made this suggestion. There'll be an article coming out about it to the occupied people. And that is, if you said that every person in California, as an example, can only spend $100 per person on any election, period, whether a corporation is a person or not, which it's not, by the way, and I've written on that subject. It's crazy to call corporations people. But by the way, it's not even good. It's not even good jurisprudence. It's bad. The point of view, if you understand the legal history, which I'd be delighted to share sometime, and how corporations came to be, it's totally opposite to the entire history of what corporations have been and are. Putting that aside, the Supreme Court in this country right now, which is the worst Supreme Court we've probably had in the history of the country. You remember, these are the same guys who said, don't count the votes in a presidential election. These are the guys who said corporations are citizens. Well, in this same, with this same group of people up there, you're not going to get a different result. But if you say nobody can do more than $100, whether they're a corporation or individual, all of a sudden people, power counts more because there's more of us than there are them.
Well, let me jump in for a second. We're not disputing it. We have to take a break.
No,
when we come back from the break, we want to invite you to turn our attentions from not to how do we react to the situation, but how can we respond to it with innovation? What are the kinds of things that are percolating around that are absolutely innovative thinking? So we will be right back after this word.
Welcome back to Cutting Edge Consciousness, thought-provoking discussions and bold ideas from the edge of possibility.
And we are back with Cutting Edge Consciousness. This is Barnett Bain here with my co-host, Freeman Michaels, and our guest, Rinaldo Brutico. Freeman, before the break, there was something that you wanted to bring up.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I feel like we're headed in a particular direction, and I want to just aim and talk about that because you were bringing up the local currency, which I love local currency. I love the idea of being able to get as close to the individual making choices as possible.
And as close to personal responsibility.
This is where I wanted to get to. So one of the things I talk about with how we want to be in a relationship with these pieces of paper. They're called Federal Reserve notes. I like to call them thank you notes. I like to express gratitude when I'm paying for something as an energetic exchange, and it's a way of personalizing what I'm purchasing. And I think, again, I mentioned that goodwill is the bottom line, at least from my perspective, that we create these relationships and we begin to build these. It's the value that we create and the trust that we build, and that becomes really important. We had a show recently. We were talking about social media and how at no time in history has your reputation been more important, because the ability for someone to review your restaurant or dry cleaners or whatever is so immediate, and it's so vast how it gets spread, that really taking care of your customer has a whole new connotation today. But the challenge I think many of us face is we're caught up in a paradigm, and it lacks vision. It lacks personal vision. It lacks a sense of my own sense of my own ability.
And community vision.
Correct. To generate and create the experience that I want to live into. And so as much energy as we spend resisting what is, I would like to move the conversation to creating things that are personal expressions of things I want to create and generate more of. And I feel, Ronaldo, that private currencies or local currencies, I should say, are ways of doing that.
I think they very much are. And I wrote an article, if anybody wants it, they're more than happy to just contact the Academy. We'll send them a copy, where I actually designed at the request of the citizens of Ojai Valley. And so there's a community in Ojai, community of Ojai City itself, but it's part of a larger valley called the Ojai Valley. And in that valley, there are about 8,000 people. Several of the folks there asked me, could I design for them a local currency for Ojai, which we did. And we published a little paper on it so you can get it. I mean, it's very short. It's only maybe 5 pages long. And it'll explain to you how we did that and how it works for them. But the bottom line of a local currency goes to the issue you just addressed. See, localism is more about self-reliance than almost anything else. When you start to think locally, you start to look at things that are really basic and important to life, like how good your water and how easy is it to get, which, by the way, is going to be the number one issue facing the planet, even more than food, I predict, within 10 years or less. Number two, where does your food come from and why? And how good is it? Number three, what does it cost for either one of those? Number four, where does your clothing come from and why? Where do you transact and why do you transact there? And how do you support each other in transacting with each other such that your community increasingly becomes self-sustainable rather than more dependent? Local currencies are the circulation system, like blood in your body, that permits all those pieces to come together and work as a whole. So just like your hand would stop working if you can't get blood to it from the left to the right, your community stops working if you can't keep circulation going, and Federal Reserve notes, as you correctly point out, which are thank yous or fictional pieces of money, don't help to create circulation in your community. In fact, I can make a strong case that they actually rob your community circulation. So what you want to do is be able to create a local currency, meaning something that I can take and say to you, if you're the local farmer or you're the local person who likes to knit clothes or you're the person who likes to provide water services or whatever, I can say to you, here's an Ojai dollar, or we call them Ojai bucks, and here's what it's good for. And there, and I won't get into all the complexities of it, but there are several currencies. Berkshire's would be the most oldest one. And these currencies, just to let you know, have a very old history in the United States. We used to have tons of these.
Is this scrip?
Well, you could call it scrip, because basically scrip is redeemable. But what makes the currency rather than scrip is it's not just cashable at one location. So if I'm Macy's and I give you the right to come in and buy something from me, that's scrip technically. If I give you a piece of paper that you can use for Macy's, Nordstrom's, or the shoe repair place, that's a currency.
And what happens at the federal level when they want to pick up their tax chunk? They want to take their bite out of it.
Well, what we recommend, in order for any currency to be launched in the U.S. at this time, you have to tie it into the federal system. So what you would do is you would have a local bank. In this case, we approached, and they were happy to do it, the Ojai Community Bank, and said, look, we want you guys to be the place where people can bring in local currency in exchange for federal dollars, so they can then meet federal obligations. As an example, and this is a good place to transition because people have grease on their minds right now.
Mm-hmm.
What we've written about and talked about for at least 3 months now is the solution in Greece is to create a neo-drachma.
Mm-hmm.
So what is a neo-drachma? A neo-drachma would be a currency created by the old drachma, brought to modern-day form, issued by the country of Greece, only good for the following two purposes. Number one, for any exchange between any two Greeks in Greece using a Greek product. So something tied to the local economy, because that exchange will then rise and fall based on true labor rates, and it will permit the Greeks to rebalance their economy. Number two, it should be allowed to be used for paying taxes to the Greek state. However, if you want to sell an olive to another Greek, fine, use a neodrachma. You want to sell an olive to a Spaniard, now you got to use a euro because you crossed the border. Why is this important? Because you see right now the problem is Greece has to rebuild its own basic economy, but the French won't let them because the French are saying you have to charge artificially high prices for your produce or you'll compete with French farmers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is all about. So if you say, hey, you know what, guys, you fell off the wagon. Okay, if you want to just transact within Greece, you don't want to need to really buy and sell around the world too much. Forget the euro thing. Let's get you some neodrachmas, and let's make them worth what a drachma is really worth, not the pretend value of a euro, which is 200 to 300% more than what a drachma should be worth.
Well, this is an inspiring development, a really inspiring development. And then when you add in other little bits and pieces and refinements, things like maybe declining interest rates as opposed to appreciating interest rates. You use it or lose it so that not all currencies, maybe some of them, but not all currencies are necessarily predisposed to hoarding.
Well, see, right now, interest rates, take that as an example. Interest rates have no relationship to anything real. They're set artificially by the federal government, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interest rates in a neodrachma, and by the way, and I believe there should be a neo-lira, a neo-peseta. In other words, every country in Europe should have its own neo-currency for strictly internal processing of transactions, because that doesn't threaten the European Union. And what it does do is create a chance for each economy domestically to find its own balance point. So the Greeks can literally pay their laborers in their own olive garden at an appropriate Greek price. They don't have to pay them what a guy has to make in Paris. Now all of a sudden the Greek olives are affordable for other Greeks. And if they get big enough and they keep building their economy, then eventually they'll start selling to the outside world. And, of course, then they'll go back to euros. In the meantime, you don't have to stick them with austerity to clamp down. You notice that every single month, when they talk about how the Greeks are going to repay this debt, the Greek situation is worse because the unemployment got higher and the economy went lower.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's suicide.
It's suicidal.
Yeah.
So how do you break this suicide thing? You say to the Germans, God bless you, we understand you're afraid of runaway inflation. We know what happened with the Weimar Republic when a barrel of Marx would buy one loaf of bread.
Right.
What we're talking about here is let the Greeks rebuild their economy. Yes, they screwed up. Okay, we're not here to punish them here. We're here to help them get out of it. In the meantime, we just cut them off from the free flow of euros unless they want to pay the full euro price.
And what keeps the neo-drachma from evolving into the same... First of all, it is something that is being grown inside the same culture as the old drachma. What keeps it from evolving and devolving into the same kind of economic morass?
Well, first of all, the old drachma wasn't bad. Don't forget, the reason they dropped
the euro, yeah.
The euro,
yeah.
And the reason they went to the euro is because somebody said, we'll give you unlimited amounts of cash if you want to come on board.
But, Ronaldo, that was a process that was locked in time. Given time, had it not become a European community, given time, each one of these nations and each one of these economic systems within each nation would inevitably devolve to a version of what we have now.
No, I don't agree. No. Look, I mean...
there would still be an oligarchy in every state that would be controlling and manipulating money with no good in service.
So one of the things that I started out talking about was the aristocracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of change, asking people's conscious to change, is it gets easier if they see the crap they're creating right in front of their face.
Yeah.
When you take it off in the distance and you put it behind a curtain, all of a sudden they don't know what's happening. Let me give you an example.
That's a powerful statement.
Okay. Now, in the United States of America, we've gone from hundreds, if not thousands, of independent media outlets to say that now we got six.
Yeah.
And those six, and I don't think anybody challenges this, those six are, generally speaking, fairly Republican.
You basically have two.
Yeah, that's right.
What are the two?
Well, you have the right and the left.
You have the left, right, and you have a right.
No.
And even those are the same.
MSNBC is owned by NBC. Okay?
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you've only got six companies that control everything. And if you think I can get on MSNBC and say what I want, and it's not going to kick the people off of CBS, and NBC rather, you're mistaken. Right now, you've got a situation where the entire conversation that happens in America is controlled through a filter that is corporate in nature. Period, end of statement, with
sure.
the exception of the internet. And that's why they tried to keep. That's why they tried to kill the internet.
It's a pretty big exception, because we recognize that while we're broadcast, the larger footprint is our internet. exposure.
It is. And you notice the fight Viacom and Hollywood put up just 3 weeks ago to strangle the Internet.
Yeah.
They wanted the permission to control who had access to the Internet. Why do you think they want that? Because this is the one thing that squirted out they couldn't control. And the reason I'm raising is not because I think the people are inherently evil geniuses that run these companies, but what happens is the profit motive in a distant area ends up becoming the driver, and the local area gets screwed. Let me give you one last example you'll relate to. John Jacob Astor. The reason why John Jacob Astor was a terrible environmentalist was he was living in New York, and he didn't care what the hell they did to get the beaver pelt. When you don't care what the guy's doing 3,000 miles away, all you want is money back. The Spaniards did the same thing with gold in the 1500s from the New World. It's the oldest story of mankind. If you are going to do it to someone else, it's really hard to get away with it if you do it in front of their face. And what we need to do to shift consciousness in this country is bring back a sense of localism, bring back a sense of immediacy, and most of all, bring back an awareness that you don't do anything to anybody that doesn't come back and hit you too.
Yeah, this is actually right. A principle here that we personalize everything and that we make personal choices and direct our experience versus assigning other people directorialship in our lives.
Anyway, as you can tell, I get very passionate about this subject because I believe that we are running out of time. And if anybody wants it, I did a speech in Italy not too long ago, which was called The Role of Business at a Time of Conscious Evolution. So what is the role of business if we're at this very unique time, a period of conscious evolution? And that becomes to me a very, very important topic. And in that talk, I took people back to that original gross merchant, and I brought them through the salt monopoly under Louis XIV, all the way to the Hudson Bay Company, up to modern-day society. And then I tied it to the work, and I'm sure you guys know the work of Barbara Marx Hubbard, my dear friend. And when she speaks about conscious evolution, she has a premise which is correct. And the premise is this. We're in the 32 or 33 precursor humanoid species that we come from, all of which are terminated now, we, Homo sapiens sapiens, are at the only time that human society has not had enough time that we could biologically adapt to the problems we created. Because the problems we're creating are on a global scale and they're far too large. So either we will consciously choose to evolve, which we've never had to do before because we did it by default, either we consciously choose to evolve, or we will see mass die-offs and destruction globally. To put a number to that, within less than 75 years, you will see at least 80% of the world's population decimated, dead. That's like 6 billion plus people, unless we act relatively soon. Because we haven't realized that we are literally destroying ourselves. So the argument about deficits is a form of suicide economically. What we're doing to the environment and climate change, that's suicide globally.
Let's jump in for a second. We have only about 90 seconds left, and I want to ask your thoughts about servant leadership, stewarding the largest of our corporations. What is the prognosis for that?
Well, first of all, thank you for bringing that. I don't know if you realize, but when I was first asked by my partner, George Zimmer, to get involved with the Men's Warehouse 20 years ago, one of the things we agreed upon early on was we were going to run the company by steward leadership. So if you would talk, and I urge any listener to go do this, go into any Men's Warehouse store in America and ask the people behind the cash register what they think about servant leadership, and they'll tell you that's why we're so successful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, what is that, a $2 billion company a year?
2.5.
Yeah.
And by the way, the only company on the New York Stock Exchange that's never lost money 1 year that's been public, ever. The only company in the New York Stock Exchange that's debt-free as far as I know. And the only company that keeps making money hand over fist and does it with employees who every year vote for us to be one of the best companies to work for in America, as independently determined by Fortune magazine. We're in what's called the Fortune.
So what are the three or four guideposts to developing servant leaders?
Okay, well, servant leadership, as it was described by books written by Robert Greenleaf and the Greenleaf Center, is basically the sense that you come to work knowing that you come to serve rather than come to take. You come to give rather than to dominate. And then when you do this, what happens is it creates a culture of servant leadership, which the customer then experiences, and then you get that back in terms of enhanced profitability.
So let's drill down a second to what it required, what is required in an executive, in a C-suite, to develop the capacity for self-reflection,
okay.
to turn from self-interest to a conjointed interest of the self and a view of the community as an expression of self, an expansion of self. What does it take for that executive to suddenly have a shift in personal values?
Two things. It takes an absolute, unflinchable commitment to values-driven leadership. You have to be willing to have values-driven leadership, not dollar-driven leadership. Number two, it takes an absolute, you cannot waver commitment to personal growth and development because you realize,
bingo,
the trust factor, that you realize that as you personally grow and develop, your company and your organization does too, and everybody does better. It's 1 + 1 = 3.
Well, so right there is the love grenade. You just put your finger right on the evolutionary button.
Our biggest challenge right now is we've run out of time, which is really unfortunate because we've sort of just scratched into.
This is Ronaldo's worst fear, running out of time. Don't say that to the man.
No, no.
I can live with it. I can deal with it.
Wait, Fred, we have enough time. We have much, much more time. We will have you back, and next time we will have you in studio. This has been a thrilling conversation and a delightful conversation and a fun conversation and a sobering conversation all at once. And we cannot wait to have you back.
But for our listeners, we need to give them the website because I'd love for them to be able to go again. I know you gave it earlier, but I'd like you, please, Ronaldo, to give it again so folks can access some of your information.
WorldBusiness.org is www.worldbusiness.org.
Okay, and I hope that you all check that out. I hope that you, if you enjoyed this show, please share it with others, and we invite you to keep coming back to Cutting Edge Consciousness.